This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Ohio Mysteries. We have a rare multi-part story that starts tonight. We usually don't do this, but this is an exception, and I promise you will enjoy it. So, let's go over our week in review so we can jump right in. Last Sunday, Paula brought us the interview with the Seeking Justice team who is trying to piece together the curious death of a Parma native. Then, on Wednesday, Ohio Mysteries Backroads, Mike and Dan cover the 50th anniversary of the Xenia tornado that claimed the lives of 36 people. Now, let's throw another log on the fire, campers. Let's dig up a new mystery. I'm your co-host, Steve Yoder, and with us as always is our award-winning journalist who spent 30-plus years at the Akron Beacon Journal telling stories just like this one, Paula Schleiss.
Hi, everybody. On April the 12th, 1862, 1 year to the day that the Civil War began, a group of volunteer soldiers from Ohio slipped into Georgia wearing civilian clothes and with an ambitious plan in mind. They wanted to steal a locomotive called the General in the deep south city of Marietta, then take it for a race into the North Georgia mountains. Throughout this journey, they would cut telegraph lines, destroy tracks, and burn bridges all the way to Chattanooga, Tennessee. In doing so, they hoped to wreck a critical infrastructure that was supplying Confederate forces and open the way for the Union Army to travel deeper into enemy lines and change the course of the war. Ultimately, their plan failed due to an intrepid young conductor from the General who refused to stop pursuit of the train even when other company men had given up. And he chased those damn Yankees for miles until the fleeing train finally ran out of fuel. Most of the Ohio raiders would be caught, some of them executed, some obtaining freedom after a daring escape from an Atlanta prison. The survivors would become the first men to be awarded the newly created Medal of Honor. Tonight, we're going to give you part one of a three-part story, arguably the greatest adventure of the Civil War. While there are several books and films about this story, I owe most of the credit in my research to a 2009 book by Russell S. Bond called Stealing the General. Bond wrote, "Most of all, like many Civil War stories, the history of the Andrews Raid is a story of ordinary men far from home, called to do extraordinary things in service of their country. It is a story of boldness, adventure, determination, hardship, and heroism on all sides." So, settle back and enjoy this unique tale that historians have come to call the Great Locomotive Chase.
Thank you.
February of 1862, an Ohio army captured a pair of forts in Tennessee, and Nashville became the first Confederate state capital to fall to the Union. The city was surrendered to Ohio Brigadier General Don Carlos Buell. One of the men in service to General Buell was James Andrews, a native of Kentucky. He wasn't military. He was a civilian, a secret agent, and a scout. And he brought to General Buell a daring plan to help American forces penetrate further into the South beyond Nashville. Andrews wanted to take a volunteer train crew into the South and steal a train. And they would return to Tennessee with it, leaving havoc in their wake, tearing down telegraph poles, burning bridges, destroying track. Railroads, after all, played an important role in the American Civil War when it broke out in 1861. It enabled both the North and the South to move and assemble large masses of troops, as well as provide them with the supplies necessary to wage a conflict that would stretch out for 4 years. So, cutting any transportation corridor could do a lot to cripple the enemy. General Buell approved of the expedition and sent Andrews to collect volunteers from the regiment of Major General Ormsby Mitchell. Mitchell was raised in the southwest Ohio towns of Piqua, Lebanon, and Xenia. At the age of 18, the brilliant young man received an appointment to the National Military Academy at West Point, where he became good friends with an upperclassman named Jefferson Davis, the same Jefferson Davis who would one day lead the Confederate States as its president. After graduating West Point, Mitchell moved to Cincinnati, where he passed the bar, practiced law, and then joined the faculty at Cincinnati City College. When the Civil War broke out, he was already in his 50s, but he didn't hesitate to offer his services to the Union Army. President Lincoln appointed him head of a 10,000-man regiment of Ohio volunteers. Mitchell's men helped Buell's Ohio Regiment capture Nashville, and then he was put in charge of rebuilding bridges that the retreating rebels had destroyed. That's the work they were doing in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, when James Andrews showed up to ask for volunteers for his special secret assignment. Several men stepped forward and volunteered, even after being given little to no information about specifically what they would be called on to do. They were simply told to gather civilian clothing, and the men did their best to assemble what they could. In the end, most of them were in a hodgepodge of fabrics that made them look like country bumpkins. Corporal Daniel Dorsey, a 24-year-old from Lancaster, Ohio, in Fairfield County, went tent to tent, pulling together a coat, a vest, a cap, but he had no luck finding a replacement for his blue uniform pants. Dorsey fretted that his pants were too identifiable. His buddies teased him as he left, shouting things like, "Dorsey, you're a goner," and, "Well, that's the last we'll see of Dorsey." Private Samuel Slavens, a plump, jolly 31-year-old from South Central Ohio's Pike County, paused from his preparations long enough to send a letter home to his wife, Rachel. The couple had 3 sons, and Rachel's last letter spoke of how they all had the measles. Sam wrote, "I would like to be there to help you take care of them, but all I can do is wish you well and think of you, which is very often." It would be the last letter Sam ever wrote. At dusk, an ambulance picked up the men from the 33rd Ohio who had volunteered for the mission and took them down the road to collect more men from the 2nd and 21st Ohio regiments. The additional recruits included Corporal William Pittinger, a 22-year-old born in Knoxville and living in Steubenville along the eastern Ohio border near West Virginia. Pittinger was a country schoolmaster who also served as a war correspondent for the Steubenville Herald. When he stepped out of his tent in civilian clothes, his confused buddies surrounded him to ask if he had been furloughed or discharged. Being sworn to secrecy, he could only shake their hands as he departed. There were 24 men in all. The contemporary press would come to call them Mitchell's Raiders, after the general who commanded their regiment. But history would later call them Andrew's Raiders, after the civilian scout who led them. James Andrews was in the prime of his manhood, 33 years old, 6 foot tall, well-proportioned, with a long black silken beard, black hair, and Roman features. His men said he had a calm, gentlemanly manner, though a commanding presence. Pittinger later wrote of him, "He was more like a dreamer, a poet, or a martyr than a military leader or a dauntless adventurer, yet there was something of each of these in his composition." The men who had come to follow Andrews were all Ohioans, sons and grandsons of pioneer families. They ranged in age from 17 to 33 and included 4 railroad engineers, several farmers, 3 teachers, 2 machinists, and a cobbler. After the company was assembled, Andrews drew his men close in a grove of trees. A thunderstorm was rising, and lightning revealed each of their eager faces. Jacob Parrott recalled later, "At each peal of thunder, Andrews paused and then quietly went on. 'Now, my lads,' he said, 'you have been chosen by your officers to perform a most important service, which, if successful, will change the whole aspect of the war and aid materially in bringing an early peace to our distracted country.'" He then described how their small force would go about cutting off the region from the rebels by destroying the railroad route and enabling their buddies under General Mitchell to march forward. He said there were risks involved, and that if they were captured, they would, in all probability, be executed. He offered to allow any of them to return to camp. None of them did.
Science, science, science! Hello, podcast fans. Want to get weird with us? Come check out the Mad Scientist Podcast. We are a weekly show that looks at the history, philosophy, and hard facts behind your biggest paranormal questions.
Did the government really pay for a psychic spy program?
Yes!
Is it true that surgery got its start in grave robbing?
Yes!
Can a roller coaster really kill you?
Legally, we can't say so for sure, but sometimes,
yes! Woo!
Join myself, Chris Cogswell, and my co-host, Marie Mayhew, as we examine the science, philosophy, and history behind the strange and unusual. All to discover what's possible and plausible versus what's, well, just made up. Check us out wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The Mad Scientist Podcast.
Andrews had his men break into small groups for the journey to Marietta, Georgia. There was just no way a large group of men could get far behind enemy lines, but a couple of men might easily dodge attention. They were all to meet again in 4 days in Marietta, where they would steal a train coming out of Atlanta and begin the next phase of their adventure. Andrews told the men if any of them were questioned, say they were from Kentucky, escaping from the rule of the Yankees and hoping to join a Southern regiment in Atlanta where their friends were. if they had to, if they were really pressed, they should go ahead and enlist, then desert when possible. Andrews passed out Confederate money, and the men walked off in pairs or sets of three or four in the now pouring rain. They were not expected to see each other again for 200 miles. William Pittinger, that bespectacled teacher and war correspondent, traveled in a group of four. His companions included William Campbell, a giant of a man, over 6 feet tall and weighing 250 pounds. William was a civilian, the only civilian other than Andrews himself. He was born in Celineville, about 30 miles from Youngstown, and was one of six brothers with a reputation for getting into trouble. A local legend was that they watched their father struck and killed by a wagon while crossing the street with a keg of beer, and that the brothers sat down and consumed the beer while discussing what to do with their old man. William worked on river barges and had a taste for adventure, but he wouldn't join the Union Army. Still, he was in the camp of the 3rd Ohio, visiting his brothers and friends, when he learned of the opportunity to join Andrews' Raiders. Though no one can say why, he decided to join. The third man in this group of four was Charles Philip Shadrach of the Ohio 2nd. The 21-year-old, born in Pennsylvania and raised in Ohio, enlisted in Jefferson County shortly after the war broke out. He was initially called Philip, after the family doctor, because his parents hoped he would grow up to be a physician himself. His parents even took to calling him Doc. But he grew to detest the name Philip when his brother Oliver shortened Philip to Flip. He started insisting people call him Perry. He was the fourth generation of Shadrach men to serve in the U.S. Army, his father and grandfathers having fought in the Revolution and the War of 1812. He was remembered as being merry and reckless, with an inexhaustible store of good nature. The fourth man in this small group was Private George Davenport Wilson, 32 years old, tall and slender, with sleepy gray eyes. A natural leader who had traveled extensively, he was a journeyman shoemaker back in Belmont County on Ohio's border with West Virginia. It had been a hard year for George. He had lost both his young daughter and his father. It was a grief that propelled him to enlist when the war began. Two men who set off together were Bill Reddick from Locust Grove in Adams County and John Woolen from Hamilton. Both were farmers in their 20s. Another two privates who paired off were Alfred Wilson and Mark Wood. Alfred was born in Columbus, but lived in the still primitive frontier of northwestern Ohio, near Bowling Green. He worked on his family's farm before enlisting at Perrysburg. Wood was from the same neck of the woods, a machinist living in the Wood County village of Portage. He was the only foreign-born soldier among the Raiders, having immigrated from Nottingham, England, 4 years earlier. Corporal Samuel Llewellyn, a 20-year-old coal miner from Pomeroy in southeastern Ohio, walked off with Private James Welford Smith, a Virginia-born machinist who at 17 was the youngest member of the party. Smith had joined the Army in Circleville, Ohio, without the knowledge or permission of his parents. Private Jacob Parrott and Private Samuel Robertson, both 18 years old, formed their own duo for the trek to Marietta. Like everyone else, they stumbled about 10 miles in the darkness, knee-deep in mud and soaked to the skin, before seeking shelter and giving in to exhaustion. They slept that first night in a farmhouse shed. Later, they would encounter a traveler who, at first glance, accused them of being Yankees. The teenage privates responded by drawing their guns and accusing the traveler of being a Yankee spy. "We've come a long way to fight such fellows as you," they snarled. The traveler immediately decided he must have misjudged them. They were clearly good Southerners. And they parted and went on their way. James Andrew took with him four men, Slavens and Dorsey, whom you've already met, an engineer, Will Knight, from Wayne County's Apple Creek, and Robert Buffum, a 33-year-old farmer from Gilead in central Ohio's Morrow County. He was a man with an unpredictable temperament and a record of being insubordinate and drunk. The companions traveled all night through torrents of rain, challenged only by one person who happened to be a Union cavalryman. Andrews handled the interference by whispering something to the man, who then stepped aside without further word. When morning came, Andrews left his four companions, saying he needed to speed ahead to make arrangements. So Dorsey, Slavens, Knight, and Buffum made their way to Manchester. That's where they decided to address the problem of Dorsey's uniform pants. Buffum slipped into a general store and bought a pair of cotton pants, then passed the bundle to Dorsey. They walked out of town, confident the small problem had been solved. But immediately, they came upon a rebel guard post at a bend in the road. Men armed with shotguns, demanding to know who the four men were and what they were up to. Dorsey, who had not yet changed out of his blue trousers, tried to look unconcerned. They did as Andrews had told them. Years later, Dorsey told this story by adopting a country accent. "Them Yankees is a mighty bad set," he said. "They're just tearing up things awful, stealing everything they can get their hands on and trying to force our people into their army, and we just wouldn't stand it, so we left thar. If we got to fight on any side, we're going to fight for the South. We're secesh, we are." Well, bad accent or not, it worked. The rebel guard was completely delighted to hear their story and pulled out a flask of whiskey to celebrate. As soon as the exchange was done and the men moved on, Dorsey quickly changed into his new pants and breathed a sigh of relief. Also passing through Manchester, Tennessee that day was a party of five led by Sergeant Major Marion Ross from Addison, Ohio, which is present-day Christiansburg in Champaign County. He had with him two of the company's locomotive engineers, Martin Jones Hawkins, who enlisted in Portsmouth along the Ohio River, and Private Wilson Brown of Logan County in West Central Ohio. Rounding out their group were two more privates, John Reed Porter, a devout Methodist from Delaware County, who was the most outspoken raider when it came to his faith, and Private William Bensinger, who grew up on a farm in Wayne County and was exceedingly strong from years of using an axe to clear thick woods back on the farm. The five men stopped to purchase breakfast and two pints of corn juice, fending off inquiries by claiming to be Kentuckians headed south to join the army. But 4 miles past the town, they met a more serious challenge. They ate supper at the home of an old man who was willing to feed them, though seemed very suspicious of them. Wilson Brown hoped to quell those fears through a charitable act. He noticed a stopped clock on the wall and offered to repair it. "Ah," the old man declared, "you are a Yankee then." Brown tried to cover, saying he had learned the craft from a northern man, but he wasn't northern himself. Then he gave the comment no more attention and went about fixing the old man's timepiece. They finished their meals and, for good measure, left by saying they couldn't stay a second more for fear of pursuing Yankees. All of of the various groups of raiders were finally closing in on the mountains that they needed to cross to get to Georgia. Pittinger's group spent an uncomfortable night lodged with a slave hunter who tracked runaway Negroes with bloodhounds. He boasted of having caught a great number and how profitable the business was. Later, they happened upon a teamster who, for an exorbitant price, agreed to take them eastward in his wagon. He dropped the men off in sight of the Cumberland Mountains. By Wednesday afternoon, other twosomes and threesomes started arriving, and so they decided to climb the mountain together. There were two raiders, however, who would not make it to Georgia. Sam Llewellyn, who, by the way, would one day go on to serve in Ohio's House of Representatives, and James Smith, who lived in the Columbus area, were confronted by Confederate guards in the town of Jasper, Tennessee. They stuck to the script, as everyone else had, reciting their excuse of displaced Kentuckians en route to Georgia to enlist. But these guards weren't buying it at all. What Kentuckian in his right mind would travel all the way to Georgia to join the Confederate Army, they asked. So Llewellyn and Smith, seeing no alternative, had to go for Plan B. They signed on as rebel soldiers right then and there and found themselves assigned to a field artillery unit in Chattanooga. Llewellyn's stint as a rebel artilleryman was brief. He promptly deserted. Smith, who didn't feel as safe making a break for it, continued in his unwanted position as a cannoneer for several months. That left 22 men to continue the trek toward Georgia. And on Friday morning, after three full days of slogging through the rain and the mud, they were nearing their goal. There was one more obstacle before they could reach the train that would take them from Chattanooga to Marietta. The Tennessee River, which looped around Chattanooga like a great moat several hundred feet wide. The men gathered in an area where there were a great number of other travelers waiting for ferries, so they didn't look too out of place. They listened as people passed on news of the war. That's when they learned that in their brief absence, their regiment, led by Ohio General Mitchell, had marched on after their departure, crossed the border into Alabama, and captured Huntsville. Now, this was concerning. Huntsville wasn't all that far from them, and the panic among Southerners was palpable. They suspected people would be more on guard than they had been in the days before. But the men managed to cross the river without a problem. Interesting, later, Southerners who recalled seeing them at that site thought they looked like a motley group in their unmatched garb, but it just didn't occur to them that such a large band of Yankees could have been together so far inside the Confederate lines, and that's why nobody raised the alarm. On the other side of the river, the Ohioans continued up to Market Street toward the railroad station. The street was bustling. The station itself was in chaos with long lines at the ticket office. The soldiers secured tickets for the 5 o'clock train headed south. Then they boarded the train and took their seats shoulder to shoulder among Southern strangers and a host of Confederate soldiers that were either on furlough or on their way to new postings. That evening, as the train passed into Georgia, the men tried to get some sleep. Dorsey would later say, "Nightfall was very welcome indeed, for we were ill at ease among our enemies, well knowing that if they should become aware of our intentions, our lives would pay the penalty in short order. We were greatly fatigued, and dozed and slept with one eye open, as the train rolled over the very road that we were to destroy on the morrow." It was midnight when the conductor shouted, "Marietta, Marietta!" The raiders opened their eyes to take in the lovely resort town, then disembarked and looked for accommodations in local hotels and warehouses that had rooms to let. Now we're going to change locations briefly here and whisk ourselves off a little further south to the heart of Georgia. That early Friday morning, as the Yankee soldiers tried to get some sleep in Marietta, a man named William Fuller was waking up in downtown Atlanta. He was 3 days shy of his 26th birthday and the conductor of a train called the General. He dressed in his uniform, checkered pants, black boots, an indigo coat with gleaming buttons over a dark plush vest. He had no way of knowing that his routine morning was going to develop into a day that would make him the hero of the South. Fuller was a Confederate true believer who drilled with and wanted to join a hometown militia company. But when Georgia's governor said experienced railroaders could best serve the Confederacy by staying at their posts, he remained on his job with the Western and Atlantic Railroad Company. On this morning, Fuller arrived at the train about 3:45 and did his inspection of it. There were 2 passenger coaches, a mail and baggage car, and 3 empty boxcars awaiting cargo to be loaded when they got to Tennessee. The General was built in the North, as most trains were, and placed in service 6 years earlier by its New Jersey creators. Promptly on schedule, at 4:00, engineer Jefferson Kane released the brake, blew the whistle, and the General rolled out of the depot for its trip north. In Marietta, Georgia, the Yankees, with tickets in their pocket for the General, were waking up and slowly making their way to where James Andrews had instructed them to meet. They saw for the first time now that there were only 20 of the original 24 raiders. Nobody knew that 2 of their number had been forced to join a Confederate regiment, and they also didn't know that 2 others, Hawkins and Porter, had overslept, the hotel having forgotten their wake-up call. And so Andrews laid out the plans for the day. Pittinger later wrote about this moment and Andrews' speech to them. He said, "There was suppressed fire in his low, almost whispered words, a calm confidence in his tone that was contagious. There seemed to be no doubt, hesitation, or shrinking on his part, but on the contrary, an eagerness and a joy that the time was so near at hand. 'Get seats near each other in the same car,' Andrews said, 'and when the train makes the big shanty breakfast stop, keep your places till I tell you to go. If anything unexpected happens, look to me for the lead.'" Andrews asked if there were any questions, and Sergeant Major Marion Ross stepped forward. The news of General Mitchell taking Huntsville bothered him. Surely Confederate authorities were on the alert. Ross wondered if they should consider delaying or canceling their plans altogether. Andrews listened thoughtfully, then responded that any man was free to back out. The risk was great, he agreed, and there was no shame in stepping away. If anyone had qualms, they were free to work their way back to the North on their own. Andrews told them, "I will succeed in this, or leave my bones in Dixie." Jacob Parrott later wrote of Andrews, "Never was there such a leader. We would have trusted him to the ends of the earth." Indeed, nobody backed out. The General finally arrived in Marietta, and the 20 remaining raiders boarded her. The loss of Hawkins, one of the men who had overslept, was a significant one. He was the most experienced engineer of the party and had been the one chosen to take charge of the engine. But they did still have three other engineers, and they would make do. The train chugged north, and finally the conductor, William Fuller, shouted, "Big Shanty, 20 minutes for breakfast." The train squealed to a stop. This was where the men intended to seize the train. Passengers were hurrying to be the first out so they could grab a table for a breakfast of eggs, grits, biscuits, and gravy. The Ohioans waited for the rush to end, watching their leader, Andrews, for direction. Then Andrews stood up and joined the tail end of the coach. The others stood and followed him. When they got outside, they couldn't help but notice that to the left of the tracks was a Confederate encampment, hundreds of tents pitched in a field. But it was early, way too early for the buglers who would awaken them. This was it. Time for one of the boldest dashes in American history. Come back and join us Wednesday for part two of the Great Locomotive Chase. Our 19 Ohio soldiers and their leader, the Kentucky-born civilian spy, James Andrews, are now in place, having snuck deep into enemy lines with the intention of stealing a train called the General. In part two, we're going to go along with them on their journey as they race north, hoping to cause destruction, while that intrepid conductor William Fuller pursues them without pause.
That's it for tonight, listeners. For photos, news clippings, and more on this and every episode, hop on over to OhioMysteries.com. And we will see you here next week for another episode of Ohio Mysteries.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.